KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation. Ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, soda taxes, condoms, food labels, and pot. Health-related issues on the November ballot, including Prop 37, a dust-up over genetically modified food.
The point that I think really, you know, people should keep in mind here is that genetic engineering isn't an ingredient. It's not like saturated fat or MSG. It's a technology.
Also in Los Angeles, voters are deciding whether actors in the county's porn industry should be forced to wear condoms. And in San Diego, pushing back against the Fed's crackdown on medical marijuana.
It's immoral to make me choose between suffocating and doing business with a drug dealer.
And the future of Obamacare after November 6th, it's the California Report. From New York City to California, local officials are pushing ideas to get consumers to cut down on soft drinks. Health experts say sugary drinks like Coke and Pepsi contribute to obesity and diabetes. And now, two California cities, Richmond, just north of Berkeley, and El Monte in L.A. County, are asking voters to approve taxes on those drinks. More on that in a minute, but first, the reaction of some Richmond residents we talked to.
I think that it is absolutely ridiculous. Healthier food is more expensive than junk foods, so I can definitely see that if they raise the taxes on junk food and then lower the prices on healthier food, such as vegetables, then that would be make more sense. But just taxing junk food alone, absolutely not.
What I've noticed is that there's a huge influx of out-of-state money and money from large corporations to defeat this initiative because it's in their best interest to keep selling people poison.
Right now I'm working at La Florida Jalisco Market. If this tax passes, our concern is that people will buy less sodas, and we do not sell alcohol here. So if we can't afford to pay rent just because the sodas increase the tax, then we might have to put in beer and alcohol in here. That's not going to help Richmond out.
That's Dionisio Archiga, Jed Kreinberg, and Kira Chapman Green talking about that proposed soft drink tax in Richmond. If voters there and in El Monte say yes, they could be the first in the nation to tax sodas, energy drinks, and other sugary beverages. But as the California Report's health reporter Mina Kim explains, getting people to change their behavior is far more complicated than adding pennies to the price of a soda.
Jorge Cota says he always gets a little nervous when he comes here to Children's Hospital in Oakland for his bi-monthly weigh-in.
Because I'm wondering, oh, did I lose this much weight or did I not lose this much? If I gain weight, I'm going to be mad. It's just a lot of things going through my mind that I get nervous about when I come to doctors, especially here.
It was here about a year ago when Jorge was 16 that he learned his health was in trouble.
They told me that I was pre-diabetic. They told me that I also had high blood pressure, and they thought there was something wrong with my heart or my kidneys.
It was a scary moment.
That's Jorge's mom, Linda Ramos.
When I saw him, when they was telling us, he started crying. He was scared, and that woke him up.
Jorge was 5'11 and weighed 321 pounds.
So I was a pretty big boy.
And his drink of choice was Dr. Pepper. Jorge says he'd drink two or three cans or bottles of soda a day. That added up to as much as 50 teaspoons of sugar.
We just cut it out.
Again, Jorge's mom, Linda Ramos.
Not only the soda cut out, the way I cook at home for him, the junk food, the way we shop.
Ramos also took nutrition classes where she says she learned to read food labels. And Jorge made changes too. He stopped going to the corner store on his way home from school. He started ordering salads at restaurants and having water with his meals. Jorge has lost more than 70 pounds this past year and has become a valuable member of his high school football team in Tracy, a city near Stockton. And those Dr. Peppers?
If it's there, I'm not craving it because I haven't craved it for a while.
That's huge.
That's June Tester, Jorge's doctor. Tester says an entire generation has grown up with the expectation that a beverage should be sweet. She says getting kids off of them requires nothing short of retraining their taste buds.
I can't tell you, you know, how many times we've had to say milk is not just something to go with your cereal. It's actually a beverage.
But as Jorge's story shows, it takes a lot more than cutting out sugary drinks to help kids lose weight.
So the teen that I had in mind who's doing the garden internship.
Tester co-directs the weight management clinic at Oakland's Children's Hospital. She sees the kids that other doctors haven't been able to help. Her team includes physicians, nutritionists, exercise physiologists, and psychologists.
So we have clinic visits that are all very individually tailored to the kid, to their family.
So how much of a difference would it make if city officials raised the price of a can or bottle of soda? Two California cities, Richmond near San Francisco and El Monte near Los Angeles, could find out if voters pass their measures to tax sugar-sweetened beverages by a penny per ounce. That would make a 20-ounce bottle of soda cost 20 cents more. Jorge Cota says for teens like him, that won't do much.
No, I think they'll still buy it no matter what because anything that goes up, they're still going to want to buy it.
Not so fast, says Kelly Brownell, head of Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. His group has studied how consumer behaviors change when prices change.
The penny per ounce, which is the level of tax being discussed most around the country, is enough to affect consumption somewhere between probably 10 and 23% or so, which would be enough to not make it a terrible burden on consumers, but would affect consumption of the product enough to reduce healthcare costs.
More importantly, Brownell says, passage of the tax would give a big boost to a national trend away from sugary drinks that's already begun in school districts and communities where demand for fresh local food is growing.
When the beverage industry claims that this really won't affect consumption patterns, then why in the world are they fighting it so hard?
Opponents of the beverage tax say both measures would slap low-income residents with higher grocery bills and drive away customers from small businesses, which would be charged 1 cent for every ounce of soda they sell. A group funded by the soda industry has poured more than $2 million into Richmond alone to defeat its Measure N. Chuck Finney with the No on N campaign says Richmond officials' claims that they'll use the tax revenue to fund anti-obesity programs is false.
All of the money flows directly into the general fund, unrestricted. Not a single penny is being raised specifically for anti-obesity programs.
Indeed, it seems what voters will weigh is whether or not it's worth it to raise costs on consumers and business owners for a solution that won't by itself wipe away obesity, but could add to a growing awareness of the impact of sugar on the obesity epidemic. For the California Report, I'm Mina Kim.
For more on the soda tax measure in Richmond and what people think about it, go to our website, californiareport.org. One health-related ballot measure getting nationwide attention is Proposition 37, which goes to the heart of how much information consumers should have about their food. Prop 37 requires labeling on raw or processed food that's made from certain genetically engineered materials. It also prohibits calling any foods like that natural on the package. Supporters say consumers have a right to this information, but opponents say the measure is misleading and full of loopholes. Here to help us sort it out is KQED science reporter Amy Standen. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Scott.
Well, let's begin with sort of a background question. How are genetically engineered foods used right now? How prevalent are they?
Very prevalent. In fact, pretty much everything you'll find in that sort of middle of the supermarket, so that's everything from sodas to crackers to cereals to cookies, almost all of that contains genetically modified ingredients. And that's because most of the corn and the soy and a lot of the rice grown here in the States is made from these genetically engineered seeds.
So therefore, it sounds like if Prop 37 passes, that these labels that would be required would be on pretty much, you know, I don't want to say everything, but like a lot of what we buy.
A lot of things. Yeah. And that's the main argument you hear from the No on 37 camp, which is that unless manufacturers start buying from farmers who aren't using these seeds, they're going to have to suddenly start labeling pretty much everything that's out there.
And so what is the main argument on behalf of Prop 37 that they're making? Is it a right to know, basically?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the line you hear over and over again, that consumers have a right to know. They say GMO labeling is mandatory in Europe. It has been since 2003. And they also say that the FDA doesn't regulate this technology enough.
There have been a lot of ads on both sides on television. Let's hear just a little bit of the Yes on 37 ad, then we'll come back.
A new study links genetically engineered corn to tumors and organ damage. And the big agrochemical corporations also say BT toxins are safe for us to eat. We shouldn't be forced to gamble with the health of our families. We have the right to know what's in our food. Vote yes on Proposition 37.
So, Amy Standen, clearly there in that advertisement for Yes on 37, sort of a fear of the unknown. And is there a basis for that?
It is very hard to say in a blanket statement sort of way whether or not these products are safe or not. I mean, of course, it's worth noting that we Americans have been eating massive amounts of these products for decades. The scientific studies that we see done on these products tend to be on mice. They're very short term. They're very small. There's been very little there that's conclusive.
So one of the Yes on 37 ads links genetically modified foods to tumors.
Exactly.
Is that one of those studies
you're talking
about?
That's one of those studies. And actually, that highlights a big problem with this argument in general, which is that it's very hard to find science that didn't come from a side of this camp with a vested interest in a certain outcome. In that case, it was a well-known advocate or activist against genetically modified products. I mean, the point that I think really, you know, people should keep in mind here is that genetic engineering isn't an ingredient. It's not like saturated fat or MSG. It's a technology.
Well, and if you look at the campaign financing for this ballot measure, opponents of Prop 37 have vastly outraised proponents.
Yes.
Something like 9-1, and
yes.
Some very well-known food companies like Kraft and Heinz have given big bucks, along with biotech and chemical
mm-hmm.
companies like Dow, Monsanto, mm-hmm. DuPont. So what's at stake for them?
Their fear is that this is going to create a bias in the marketplace and that they're going to be scrambling for new suppliers, and it'll disrupt the market.
And, of course, what happens here in California could,
exactly.
could go
yeah,
east.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, of course. I mean, California is such a big market that it's just not worth it for manufacturers to produce two lines of products. So very likely, if you see the labeling here, if Prop 37 passes, this is going to become a national standard.
Well, there have been several ads for No on 37. Let's hear a bit of one of them right now.
Farmers already face a devastating drought, causing higher food prices. Now, California farmers are threatened by Prop 37, a complex bureaucratic food labeling proposition that would increase cost to food producers and consumers by billions of dollars.
One other part of this that opponents are complaining about is that it would allow consumers to sue companies that don't fully comply with these new regulations,
yes.
which, of course, would be a boon for lawyers.
Under Proposition 37, plaintiffs don't have to prove damages. Really, how would you prove that you have been damaged by a box of unlabeled GMO Triscuits, right? On the other hand, the opponents of this proposition really fear that we would see these lawsuits clogging up the courts, and that you would see small grocery store owners spending a lot of time and money defending themselves.
And no doubt we'll be seeing a lot more of all those ads and probably others between
oh, yes.
now and Election Day. Amy Standen, KQED science reporter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, you won't find it on the L.A. County Chamber of Commerce website, but the San Fernando Valley has a very big porn industry. And earlier this year, Los Angeles became the first city in the nation to require male adult film actors to wear condoms while performing. But that landmark law doesn't apply to film studios. Well, now a measure on the ballot is aiming to require the L.A. County Health Department to enforce condom use at all adult film shoots countywide, studios included. From Los Angeles, KPCC's Stephanie O'Neill has the story.
It's called Measure B, and it's backed by the L.A.-based AIDS Healthcare Foundation. That's the same organization that early this year pressured the Los Angeles City Council into adopting the nation's first law that requires adult performers to wear condoms during film shoots that take place outside of studios. Michael Weinstein is president of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. He says requiring condom use in porn is good policy.
You really can't argue that people who go to work at a job, you know, ought to be putting their health at risk. We put a thing at the conclusion of film saying that no animal was hurt in the making of this film. I mean, we can't say that about these films when it comes to people, real life people.
People like Darren James. He's a well-known former adult film performer. In 2004, his life and career crashed down around him.
I was going to just try to put myself back in school and save my money and get out. And the worst thing happened is like right at the time when I signed a contract, I contracted HIV.
How did you get notified?
Well, basically, I got a phone call over right before the weekend, from what I remember, and it was just devastating that I was numb because I figured, what, chlamydia? Now I got HIV.
James, now 48, was at the center of a highly publicized HIV outbreak that for a month shut down the adult film industry based in LA's San Fernando Valley. Three female actors who performed with him were also found HIV positive.
If you're working, you're going to get something eventually, that amount of exposure. And a lot of people tell you they never got nothing, it's a bunch of BS.
Today, James works as an HIV counselor for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. He, too, supports the mandatory condom laws, which are intended to police the industry with random inspections by health workers paid for by higher adult film permit fees. But at the moment, despite the new LA City condom law, no inspections have happened. The city's waiting to see first if Measure B passes, which would instate the broader county law. Either way it happens, adult industry officials fear the requirement will do more harm than good.
This law will actually hurt performers more than it will help.
Diane Duke is executive director of the Free Speech Coalition. That's the trade association for the adult entertainment industry that's long opposed mandatory condom use among its performers as unnecessary regulation. The rate of sexually transmitted diseases is lower among the industry's sex workers than among populations with similar demographics. She says that's due largely to stringent testing protocols the industry adopted after the 2004 outbreak involving Darren James. Since then, she says, there's been no transmission of HIV within the industry.
What we have in place works. Undermining what we have in place and the self-regulation that we've imposed into the industry goes by rigidly is unfortunate. And by mandating condoms and trying to regulate from outside, I think it's only going to hurt our performers.
Duke says mainstream adult film producers require all actors to undergo STD testing every 28 days. The results are then registered in a database that determines whether a performer is eligible to be called for work. Duke fears the condom requirement is government overreach that will only hurt the estimated 1,000 to 1,500 adult film performers who work in the LA porn industry.
We'll be looking at possibly diminishing the protocols that are in place, and it's going to make our performers much less safe than they are now.
Or, she says, the industry may go underground with productions or leave Los Angeles County altogether, taking with it an economy that's been estimated at $1 billion. Duke says the recession, free internet porn, and piracy have cut the industry earnings by about half. And she says mandatory condom laws are certain to erode profits even further. That's because most viewers prefer buying and watching films in which performers act without condoms, she says. But Michael Weinstein of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation disagrees.
I don't think that, you know, people are going to be so horrified by that little piece of latex that they're not going to be willing to purchase these films.
While Weinstein acknowledges the greater popularity associated with condom-free adult films, he believes neither the LA City Law nor LA's County Measure B will hurt profits in any way. For the California Report, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Los Angeles.
Election Day is less than a month away now, and voting is already underway. Before you cast your ballot, catch up on all the issues at our election blog. It's called What's Government For? You'll find a guide to all the statewide propositions, and while you're there, you can listen to any or all of our coverage. It's at californiareport.org/election. Well, no one has more riding on the election than President Obama, and not just because he's on the ballot. The outcome for president and Congress will go a long way toward determining whether his Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, will be fully implemented or not. For a look at how that could play out in California, we turn to Marion Mulkey. She's director of the Health Reform and Public Programs Initiative at the California Healthcare Foundation, and I should mention that they are a funder of the California Report. Marion, good to see you.
Nice to be here.
Well, first of all, the Affordable Care Act has been gradually getting phased in nationwide. Give us a sense of what's been happening up to now right here in California.
Well, California has implemented many of the early provisions of the Affordable Care Act, making some new extensions of coverage available, for example, to young adults, assuring that pre-existing conditions are covered for children, and implementing many of the early programs, a program for people with pre-existing conditions that is in place and is covering people already. And they've taken steps in terms of planning and establishing a state-based exchange, which is the marketplace by which people will be able to view their choices, identify what's available for them, and access federal subsidy support for buying coverage.
And it's fair to say California has been further out in front on that than pretty much any other state.
Yes, California was an early was early in determining that it wanted to have a state-based exchange and moved quickly immediately after the passage of the law in 2010 to start one up and to make some initial decisions.
So a lot of us thought, or some people thought, that after the Supreme Court weighed in and basically affirmed the Affordable Care Act, that that would kind of be the end of the story. But we do have this big election coming up, the president, Congress, up on the line. What's at stake, if that's the right way to say it? What could change depending on the outcome of that election?
Well, certainly everybody's eyes are on the presidency right now, and certainly there's a difference. If Obama is reelected, then we remain on the path that we understand pretty well now in terms of implementing the Affordable Care Act. If Romney is elected, then I think it's fair to say at minimum that there's a little bit of a pause, that the inertia slows, that people are looking toward Washington, and it will likely take months before it's really clear what the new administration intends to do and what Congress will allow or encourage them to do.
And last month, Governor Brown vetoed a couple of bills that basically would have required health insurers to cover all Californians, regardless of pre-existing conditions, even if the Affordable Care Act is gutted by the new president or the Congress. And the governor vetoed both those bills. Why do you think he did that?
There was certainly pushback from the insurance industry about the separating that individual mandate that's in the federal law from the guaranteed issue or the requirement to sell to everyone regardless of their health that was in the state law. But I think it's fair to say that there were many details in those bills. They compromised across all the stakeholders on some of them and apparently didn't get all the way to a compromise that the governor could uphold when it came to his desk. I think it's likely that those issues will be revisited very soon in 2013.
Now, looking ahead to January, we understand that the governor intends to call a special session of the legislature focusing on health. How might this election determine what they focus on?
If President Obama is reelected and we appear to continue down this path toward implementing the Affordable Care Act, then California has many pieces of unfinished business around the specific way we do that. The individual market rules that you described earlier, certainly the way that we expand and pay for a Medi-Cal expansion, those would be immediately it would be high on the to-do list for the legislature. On the other hand, if the president is not reelected, if Mitt Romney is in the White House, or if the Governor Brown's budget proposition, the tax proposition, Proposition 30, doesn't pass, then I think attention will go in many different directions. It won't be so focused narrowly on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, but instead there may be higher priorities with respect to balancing the state budget.
Well, we'll know a lot more in about 3 weeks.
Yes.
All right. Marion Mulkey, Director of the Health Reform and Public Programs Initiative at the California Healthcare Foundation, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
It has been 16 years since California voters legalized medical marijuana, but the issue is far from settled. The federal government has been pushing back, forcing storefront pot shops to close their doors all across the state. Well, now voters in four San Diego County cities will see measures to authorize medical marijuana dispensaries. From KPBS, Kenny Goldberg tells us even if the measures win, patients might ultimately lose.
Vay Linville has severe emphysema. He needs bottled oxygen to survive. When Linville was first diagnosed, doctors told him without a double lung transplant, he'd soon be dead. Linville got his affairs in order. Then one day, when he was searching on the internet, he discovered a treatment for breathing problems that used to be widely prescribed in the 1800s, tincture of cannabis. Linville found a recipe for it and decided to make it himself.
And I went out and joined one of the clubs, one of the dispensaries, and was able to buy approximately a quarter pound of concentrates that I put in a small amount of alcohol and consumed over about 10 weeks. And instead of dying as expected, here I am 6 years later, doing better and better.
These days, Linville uses just a few drops of the tincture in his tea. But getting any amount of marijuana is difficult because nearly all dispensaries in San Diego County have been closed. Linville says that puts him in a tough spot.
It's immoral to make me choose between suffocating and doing business with a drug dealer.
Linville is with the group Americans for Safe Access. With the help of some local activists, they've placed a measure on the November ballot in Imperial Beach. It's a town of 26,000 people that's the most southern beach city in California. Prop S would repeal Imperial Beach's ban on medical marijuana dispensaries. It would allow dispensaries to open for business under specific zoning and operational requirements. Imperial Beach business owner Marcus Boyd is one of the driving forces behind Prop S. Boyd became an advocate back in 2008 when his sister was dying in a local convalescent home. Boyd says marijuana helped relieve her pain. One night, she asked staff for a joint. She wanted them to call Boyd to get one for her.
They asked, and a couple hours later, she passed away. When I found that out the next morning by going there, I made a commitment to myself and to her that I would make sure that people in need are able to find medicine when they need it.
Boyd says Prop S limits dispensary operating hours and has more than a dozen other restrictions to protect patients and the community. Nonetheless, Imperial Beach Mayor Jim Janney and the majority of the city council are against it. Janney's not opposed to medical marijuana per se. He thinks patients should be able to get it. But Janney says the authors of Prop S went overboard.
It was as simple as saying, I want to allow for three storefronts in Imperial Beach, they would have said that, but they didn't do that. We could have up to 19 or 20 of them or more, depending on how you locate them. I think that's way too far, and I don't think that that was good law. I don't think that's really the way it should work.
Imperial Beach voters won't be the only ones in November to decide whether to allow dispensaries in their town. Voters in the San Diego County communities of Solana Beach, Del Mar, and Lemon Grove will also weigh in. But even if these measures pass, there are no guarantees that any medical marijuana dispensaries will be allowed to operate. That's because the U.S. attorneys throughout the state have been aggressive in enforcing the federal ban on marijuana. Over the past year, they've shut down dispensaries in a number of cities, including Oakland, Los Angeles, and San Diego. In July, U.S. Attorney Laura Duffy sent a letter to the city attorney in Del Mar. The letter said city employees who conducted activities mandated by their dispensary ordinance would not be immune from federal prosecution. Duffy wouldn't agree to be interviewed for this story. After pressure from activists, the Los Angeles City Council has decided to overturn a ban on medical marijuana dispensaries it had approved just months ago. That means an estimated 1,000 storefronts in the city are operating totally unregulated. For the California Report, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Mahler is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. We had production help from Shuka Kalantari. Our production team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, and Ingrid Becker. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the California Endowment. Health happens with prevention at calendow.org, and Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.